If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTradio.live.
Politically incorrect.
Correct. This is Politically Incorrect with Mike Tennessee and Richard Carson on TNT Radio.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening. This is Richard Carson on Politically Incorrect. And today we're going to have a chat to a gentleman who's well known to TNT Radio, Lieutenant Colonel Alastair Pope, retired. Although, in my opinion, Alastair, you're anything but retired. You would be known as a bush of thorns and a very thorny character in the backside of our magnificent Defence Department and many other areas. So I'd like to have a quick recap on a few things that have happened here in Australia in the last week or so, which and get your thoughts on the Ben Roberts Smith findings. And in coordination with that, because you've spoken to us in the past about the Yamashita principle, where do you think that leaves the hierarchy of the Defence Force?
Well, one of the issues is that Brereton, and I wrote about this and sent a letter to the Australian a long time ago. Mm. Brereton actually announced, in contravention of the Yamashita principle, or the Yamashita standard, that we couldn't hold the senior hierarchy accountable because they were too far from the scene of the action to know what was going on. Now, that, of course, is entirely against what the Yamashita principle actually says. But that was his,
Was he the Minister for Defence in the Labor Party some time ago? Is that fellow?
No. Brereton actually is a Major General. He was, in fact, he joined the Army Reserve and rose up through the ranks there. But right. He is, in fact, a KC. And he was appointed to carry out the investigations into the allegations of war crimes in Afghanistan.
Right.
So he has a, you might say, a vested interest, and he's already part of the club bloat, 172 generals and senior officers that we have running the tiny army that we've got.
He was actually protecting his backside by making that type of an announcement then.
Well, not his. He was protecting the club because being the head of this review board, he actually then managed to twist the black letter of the Yamashita principle and saying, well, we can't really blame them because they weren't really there. The interesting thing is that General Cantwell, who wrote a book called Exit Wounds, pointed out that, and by the way, he was suffering from PTSD. He was, in fact, very much frontline, and he ended up with PTSD after Iraq. He pointed out in his book that he was constantly interfered with in his command by people like Campbell and his predecessor Morrison calling him up and saying, I've just authorized an operation in Afghanistan or Iraq, and I want to know what's going on. So these people, no, I never actually knew what was going on, yet in Campbell must be lying too, because he actually said that they actually constantly wanted to know the detail, the minutiae of what was actually going on in the field. So what you have here is that it just doesn't add up. You actually get yourself a DSC, Distinguished Service Cross, for leadership in action when you're based more than 1,000 kilometres away from the scene of the action. You might as well have been in Perth and fighting a battle in Brisbane. And then, of course, you collect your DSC and all your other awards, and then you say, but I never actually knew what was going on. As I made the joke, Sergeant Schultz and Hogan's Heroes is very much not a comedy character, but a real-life person. I know nothing. I wasn't there. I never saw anything, and I'll collect the medal. Thank you very much.
But this is a quality scenario where the person who was there is being punished, and yet these people who, under the Yamashita principle, should have been responsible for knowing what the gentleman was doing, and that's questionable anyway,
Absolutely. No,
I've spoken to a couple of people, or about 8 or 9, about this particular result, and they're all horrified that Ben Robert Smith is being impugned in a technical sense or whatever it is, when he was there, you know, putting his life on the line while these other buggers are hiding somewhere in the middle of nowhere.
They don't get it. Very much so, but that's not the real point. The real point is that the officers who were in charge, right down to the Captain Hasty level, where were they? Now, I've just finished reading a book called Mentions and Dispatches by a good friend of mine, David Sabin, who was a platoon commander in Vietnam, and he did his full 12 months, and he was one of the platoon commanders at the Battle of Long Tan.
Right.
Now, he wrote 300 letters home to his wife while he was an infantry commander in Vietnam. He virtually wrote to her every day. And even when he was out in the field, he used to take something out, and at night he would sit down and he'd write her a letter. Now, he was either leading his troops from the front, or when he was having a bit of a rest and the half platoon had gone out, then it was under his sergeant. As soon as they came back, he interviewed them in detail as to what did you do, what did you see, what happened, what incidents did you come across there, what signs of the enemy have you got? And he did that every single day. Even when he took his rest and recreation, which was he went to Hong Kong for 5 days, when he came back, he got detailed reports from his sergeant. Now, these people, right down the line, are saying, I wasn't there, I knew nothing, I never went out in the field, and these guys working for me are all criminals who fooled me into and never told me about all these war crimes they were committing. That, I mean, this is just not an army that's recognizable as an army.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Full of stuffed shirts.
So you would be very disappointed in what has happened to Ben Robert Smith, I would suspect.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I haven't actually read the Basanko finding yet. I mean, I know the sort of outline of it, as everyone does. But one of the things about it is that he actually concedes that four people said Ben Roberts did it. He murdered four people. And four people said, no, he didn't. And he said, on the balance of probabilities, he did. He was killing all these other people anyway. So we'll take the word of those who actually have said that he was a criminal. And now what's actually happened is that a number of people, including the Spectator, have said, well, look, it's not actually a criminal case. It was actually just a civil case. So although he's lost $13 million in fees, and he's lost his medals, and he's lost everything else, he's lost his reputation, it wasn't really a criminal case. They'll now have to take it to court to prove in a criminal court of law to a higher standard that he actually did commit these crimes. My point here is, I don't care. Because if we actually apply the Yamashita standard, it goes right up the line. Now, I have a flyer here from Brereton, who on the 4th of June gave a lecture on Australian war crimes. And he goes back, and of course he mentions the famous one, which was in fact a genuine war crime, and that was Brecker, Morant and Hancock, who were executed in 1902. Mm. Hancock was in fact Australian born, whereas Brecker, Morant was actually born in England. And at the time they committed the war crimes of killing prisoners, they actually were working for, they were actually part of a British unit, not an Australian unit.
Okay.
Put that to one side. That was a genuine war crime. When I started looking into this, of course, I then went through history and found dozens of examples of, and written into biographies. And one of our greatest heroes, Albert Jacka, VC, who probably had 3 or 4 VCs before he was gassed and badly injured. And when he came back to Australia, he became the mayor of St Kilda, and died in 1927 as an effect. It was part of the effects of being gassed in World War I. But the point there was, in his biography, he said, I captured a trench and I wounded 4 Germans and captured another 5. But then, and you had a couple of men with him, the Germans were mounting a counterattack. So I had to kill the prisoners because I couldn't look after them while fighting off the Germans to my front. Well, what do? We go back to World War One and strip him of his medals and everyone else that made these sort of comments that I couldn't take prisoners. What about the current trend, which is, as you've heard, the double tap? You shoot the guy and then you put another bullet in his head to make sure he's dead. You're now killing someone who's wounded. And in fact, O'Neill, who was the person who killed Osama bin Laden, said, when I got in there, I shot him. And then I gave him the double tap by putting another bullet in his head to make sure he was dead. You've now killed someone who was wounded and incapacitated. War crime by the rules that we're now playing by.
Yeah.
I notice actually, I haven't seen the Court of Justice in Kabul being run by the Taliban prosecuting their own beheaders and murderers and everyone else. But they're sticking out their hand and saying, we want compensation for the people that you now admit you killed.
Yeah, so it's an absolute nut of mess in real terms. And I haven't been in battle as you have. I would have thought no matter what you're doing when you're in a tight situation is you're trying to survive and so be it. That's how it would work, I would have thought.
Oh no! That's not the case. These are what are called. You've captured someone.
Yeah.
Now there was the case there that with Heston Russell, where an American pirate said, a pilot said, by the way, if you can hear anything under the sound of the rotor blades when you're picking up these people, he said, we didn't have room to carry everyone. I heard a pop, and he said, we've now made space. And he claimed that somebody had shot a prisoner. Now, what they were actually doing at the time that's supposed to happen, firstly, there's no way the pilot with his earphones on and everything else could have heard a pop. He would have to have heard something very much louder than that. But the point was there, the patrol was actually dropping off about 40 Afghans who were going to then man this outpost. And they'd captured some Taliban who they were taking back with them. There was no reason to shoot anyone and murder them because you could simply hand them over to the people who were taking over the outpost. Yet that became another one of, it's probably another war crime committed by Australians to make room. They just shot someone in the head. And then, of course, you've got Dr. Kompetz, I can't even pronounce her name. She wrote, she was hired by the military to look into the culture of the SAS and the commandos. And she wrote a very sensational report and book that she heard stories about the SAS would surround a village, separate all the men, take them down to the end, torture them for up to 3 days, and then when they left, the men and boys would be found with a throat slit. Now, I think there must be many, many villages of widows somewhere in Afghanistan, which, by the way, Brent was unable to name a single one. Yeah. But that's now become, fact that this happened. Now, you'd have to be a simpleton to believe what she told. And unfortunately, as somebody said, actually, the guys actually couldn't take her seriously. So they just tried to outvie each other for telling the most ludicrous stories, which were all then accepted and put into the Brown Report as fact. In the Brown Report, it said, actually, that there are villages in which there are no men, but he couldn't name a single one. Right. This is just, it is, in fact, truly a witch hunt. And we've now found the source of the problem that's at the corporal level, not at any level above that, not at Ben Roberts' commander level of the officer who was in charge of whatever he was doing, not at the levels above that, and certainly not at the Yamashita level, which would go all the way to the top. Now, here's just the fact here. When I wrote one of the articles, I said, I find this utterly illogical. And in fact, the officer who defended Yamashita unsuccessfully, and the Supreme Court actually confirmed his death sentence with a vote of 72, he said, there is no chance that any American commander at any level would be convicted as a result of the actions of his soldiers. Now, there's a movie which I watched, which was about an American officer who, in fact, had probably the most days in combat of any American in World War II. he joined up and they just happened to get sent everywhere. Now, he got wounded twice. He stole a plane to get back to the scene of the action. He was in Algeria and he wanted to get to Italy. So he simply stole the plane and flew it to Italy, where he rejoined his unit. Now, it was his troops at the end of World War II that killed 13 guards at Auschwitz. And, of course, the legal eagles even then sort of picked this up and wanted to court-martial him. And he was the court-martial was going forward. And at the end of it, he's actually taken into and left in General Patton's office. And Patton then enters, and it's the first time he's been in the great man's presence. And Patton said to him, did this actually happen? He said, yes, and I couldn't stop it. I stopped it as soon as I got there, but I didn't realize my soldiers were so angry they killed 13 guards at Auschwitz. And he said, Patton said, I've been in the army for 50 years. I have actually been in combat, and I counted up the number of days in which the bullets whizzed past me, and it was 10 days. You've been in combat for 541 days. Case dismissed.
Very good. Alistair, we'll just take a quick break and come right back in a few moments.
TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Now they're paying churches and houses of worship to house the illegals. And now, well, I'll let you hear this for yourself. Because I was stunned, but I'm not shocked because I know what the eventuality is. They're going to be on my streets soon, setting up tents, yeah, and everybody's streets. Yeah. Here is Mayor Eric Adams.
It is my vision to take the next step to this, to go to the faith-based locales, and then move to private residents. There are residents who are suffering right now because of economic challenges. They have spare rooms, they have locales, and if we can find a way to get over the 30-day rule and other rules that government has in its place, we can take that $4.2 billion, $4.3 maybe now, that we potentially have to spend, and we can put it back in the pockets of everyday New Yorkers, everyday houses of worship.
Isn't that great? So if you live in New York City and your neighbor decides to take in two or three or four illegals and then go to work, or even if they stay there, I mean, you now have illegals who are not vetted. You don't know if they're sick. You don't know if they're criminals. And they're living next door to you because your neighbor's going to make money off of it.
Yeah. Steve.
The Steve Malzberg Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
If you came across someone struggling with hunger, how would you recognize them? By their clothes? Their age, the way they speak? Would you notice a 16-year-old boy who got his first job?
Not for extra spending money, but to help feed his little sisters?
Or a mother who's in between jobs and sometimes goes to bed hungry so her kids can have dinner? Or a 14-year-old girl who signs up to every after-school activity not to make friends, but just to get something to eat? Or a retiree who fell ill and had to choose
between getting medicine or groceries.
I am the one in eight Americans who struggle with hunger. People you pass by every day but never knew were hungry. I am hunger in America.
Hunger can be hard to recognize. Learn why at IamHungerInAmerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America, 200 Food Banks Strong, and the Ad Council.
Mike Tennessee and Richard Carson are politically incorrect. Today's News Talk, TNT, TNT Radio.
Richard Carson back with you on Politically Incorrect. We're having a chat with a well-known supporter of ours, Alistair Pope, Lieutenant Colonel retired, and taking a new space with the Defence Force and the irregularities that appear to be everywhere. Our defence leaders, they're rushing off into all sorts of areas. The main issues appear to be anything but the defence of Australia. We're sort of worrying about transgender issues, climate change.
Diversity.
Diversity and all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
You know, here we are, we're busy attacking people who've been on the front line, and yet here at home we don't appear to be doing anything of any great consequence to pick up on where the real problems are. What's your thoughts there?
No, I mean, I pointed that out too, that And I can go back to 1982 when, in fact, everyone who was part of this, what I'm about to tell you, is still alive except General David Butler, who is one of the best officers I'd ever worked for.
Mm.
And by the way, he was wounded in Vietnam. He got a head wound. He was much more junior officer then. He got hit by shrapnel. But the point was, he actually looked at the fact, he was the head of training command, and he looked at the fact that no general that we had at the time had any experience in running anything, even to the size of a division. Because although we had a division of 9 battalions, 3 of them were in Vietnam, 1 was in Malaysia, 1 was in Singapore, and there were 4 in Australia. So no one actually was doing other than administration. So he decided to run a course. It was called the Senior Officer Study Period. It was a 5-day course to actually teach senior officers how to run large organizations up to the level of a corps. Now, Monash, of course, with the Anzacs, had 5 divisions, so he ran a corps. We hadn't had anything of that scale since World War II, and even then, a World War II example was 3 divisions overseas, 1 in Singapore, which we lost, and the rest were in Australia. But so he actually decided to run this course, and he rounded up about 15 of these generals. This is back in 1982, remember?
Right.
Actually, I've actually got the notes here, and I rated them as, I gave them all an A. An A stood for appalling, and this is 1982. And I pointed out that of the generals, 5 to 7 were listening and paying attention. Another 5 were not listening at all, and the rest were just wasting the taxpayers' money. They were all waiting for the drinky poos and the cocktails after the day was over. Unfortunately for them, the other hadn't read the brief at the beginning, because we appointed some of them to then command as they did in World War II. And we had a number of battles, the Chia River battles in southern Russia. We had Stonewall Jackson in the Shenandoah Valley, which they should have known all about these things. And the Indo-Pakistani War of 1970-71. Now, they were put in charge of the divisions.
A theoretical battle, that was what they were asked to them.
Well, no, these were real battles.
They were real battles, but then they were going to manage them.
They were now being given the scenario.
Right.
And in the first one that came up, which was the Chia River battles in southern Russia, we pointed out that General Balk had about 90,000 men. He was facing 500,000 Russians with 10 times as many tanks as he had. And he literally massacred them. He destroyed 3 armies altogether. He killed 40,000 Russians for a cost of 5,000 of his own. He destroyed about 2,000 tanks, and he completely shattered the front line and recaptured about 6,000 square miles of territory. This is 1943, after Stalingrad.
Right.
Our geniuses in 1982 decided to put the troops standing in front of the spear. And of course, General Butler played the spear, and he just overran them. And none of the generals was actually concerned that he'd actually lost this battle. What they were concerned about was that they'd been shown up for losing the battle. And so they complained about the course. It was eventually literally called off. We stopped the scenarios and just went into the theory. So I then became alarmed. And I mean, you probably find it hard to believe, but I made the comment to General Butler, who I liked very well, and he sort of tolerated me. And I said, if I were Corporal Hitler, I would be recalling these generals to give them a stiff talking to. All he could do, I could hear the sound of his teeth grinding, but he let me get away with it.
But so these generals then went on to be the nucleus and backbone of our defence
yes.
leaders. And they were incompetent there, and they probably didn't improve much going forwards.
Yeah. Now, what I pointed out, now we need a clean out. But in fact, I actually said the answer that we need is known, but will never and can never be implemented. It's like a hydra. If you chop the top 3 levels off right now, get rid of Campbell, get rid of all these people, get rid of half the 77 generals that we've got running an army of 25,000 actual soldiers in the operational area, it wouldn't change anything, because it's become a self-replicating device. It chooses people in its own image.
Right.
So when you had some like Houston chose Morrison and then Morrison chose Campbell, they become self-replicating. And so even if you chop them out, the people coming up behind them are being built in the same image. Now, I just pointed out to you the other day that for the first time, I received an email from someone in defense that said he apologizes for standing on Aboriginal land and gives, to the elders, past and present and future. And sorry, sorry, sorry. I mean, that should be a battle cry. Sorry, sorry, sorry.
Well, just on that, on the points there, what's the defense readiness for the protection of Australia right now, in your opinion?
Well, we're not ready.
Zero?
We're not. We're down to, we claim we could actually field a brigade, which is about 3,000 men. We had at one stage back in the 1970s, when I was in Townsville, we had 3rd Brigade, which was a ready reaction force. And we had to be ready to go somewhere on 28 days' notice. Now, I never was asked to go anywhere, but some of my soldiers were lined up. They were put on one of the ships, and we sailed towards Fiji. We were going to invade Fiji to rescue the tourists. And in fact, we actually got as far as, we never quite landed there, but we sailed around there, and we had managed to actually have an accident that killed some soldiers when a helicopter crashed into the sea and was never recovered, nor were the soldiers on it. But we sailed off the shore there, and the tourists who we were there to rescue were standing on the beach waving to us because there was nothing actually going on. This is when Rabuka ran his coup
in Fiji.
We were going to go there and invade Fiji and rescue these people who were waving to us from the beach because they're
having a drink.
Oh, wait, I've still got 5 days left on my holiday. Leave me alone.
But I don't think anyone heard about that.
Oh, I think they did actually at the time. This is 1978 when you were just a boy.
Indeed.
So we did that, and we had a couple of others. And later on, when I was in log command, I had something to do with the preparation of the logistics for Rwanda. And we did send, we have sent small contingents to various places. We actually sent a battalion to Somalia.
Right.
One of the two people who was, well, the only person who was killed there was actually shot by another Australian soldier accidentally. So that was our only casualty there. And that was Restore Hope. There's actually a book written about it by someone I knew. And I asked them about some incidents that had come up of the heroics of people who claimed to have been there. And he said, well, if these incidents happened, I never heard about them when I was writing the book. Because I was actually searching the book for someone who was claiming to be an absolute hero and deserved more medals. Anyway, so what's going on even then? We can't put a battalion overseas. And by the way, the German army, when it was asked to go to Afghanistan, the Americans asked them to put a brigade, about 3,000 soldiers, into Afghanistan. The Germans said, can we just supply you with equipment because we haven't got an army? We can't really sustain 3,000 soldiers. That's the German army.
It's all rather incredible to me that all of this money is being used, but we really don't have much to show for it.
Nothing. In fact, see, here's the thing about the, you got it right and I got it wrong, the Strategic Defense Report, where what they've said is our army is unfit for purpose. Welly, who knew? But Houston, who was, of course, at one stage CDF, has now said, it's unfit for purpose. We need a new army. We need all these new things. We need HIMARS. We need these nuclear submarines. We need these things. And we have to transfer into becoming a new army. And as I pointed out in an article, which hasn't been published and won't be now because of the fact that Quadrant republished my article from 2020 called the Yamashita Standard.
Right.
Well, the shadow of Yamashita falls across the ADF. But the point there was, he said, we need a new army. We've got to start from scratch. Now, what you're going to do is you're going to take the, say, 25,000 so-called operational soldiers, and you've got to transfer them into a new army. No, this one's unfit for purpose. When does the new one become effective? He said it'll take us 8 years. So now we've gone from an ineffective one army to an ineffective two armies where we transfer everyone across into this new army, give them new weapons. And of course, we've taken 8 years, and we've been through this many times. We've taken 8 years, I think we're into the ninth year now, of trying to make a decision as to whether or not we buy the German armored artillery or the Korean armored artillery. But of course, we want modifications. Whatever they've got is not good enough for us. So we've been talking about this for 8 years, and finally, when the Labour government got in, they said they would make a decision this September. Along comes Houston, and by the way, they said that a year ago. And so they're giving themselves a year to make a decision as to which one they were going to choose. And what's happened now is that Houston comes along and said, no, you don't need armored artillery. So we won't have that. So now 8 years have gone down the gurgle. I pointed out to you that the command and control systems that we were looking at, there was an Israeli company called Elbit, which actually supplied this, and they also supplied this, you've heard of the 6 degrees of separation.
Mm.
They supplied an intelligence system where Richard Carlton's talking to Alistair Pope, and we'll note that, they know each other. And so you can build up this whole network of who in the terrorist world knows everyone else through intercepts and so on. We spent nearly $1 billion evaluating it and then said, not good enough for us. Now, what the hell would the Israelis know about fighting wars against when hugely outnumbered?
Alistair, but that's crazy. We've gone and acquired something from a very, very respectable source.
And rejected
it. We spend $1 billion looking at it and then do nothing. And we take years and weeks and months and God knows what else carrying on, and we're going backwards at a great rate of knots.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask you a little bit about, you know, you've spoken in the past about who is our enemy. Well, I think the enemy is pretty well identified, and they're north of where you're sitting at the moment. These scenarios are there right now, and yet we're wandering around by the sounds of it, in an absolute dither.
Yes. We make announcements. I mean, it was 5 years ago we announced that we were building a new ammunition factory to make particularly larger scale shells for our Navy. Now, I actually made the comment that as far as I knew, they had not produced a single shell so far. And someone pointed out to me, that's wrong. They've actually been producing shells. Unfortunately, they don't work. But that's the secondary part.
But how can this be? I mean, we're not that incompetent, surely.
Yes, we are. Because the shell casings have to be made to a certain standard, you know, the right. Brass casing.
Yeah.
And having great difficulty actually manufacturing them to that standard.
Should we import those from China? I jest.
No. It's unfortunate, actually, because you just mentioned something there. One of my correspondents actually sent me a thing and said, here are the top 7 companies that supply the Australian Defence Force from China.
Oh, no.
It's cheaper.
But if we run into a bit of conflict with them, they mightn't want to give us anything. That's half a possibility.
What makes you think that?
Well, I do think that, unfortunately.
Lateral thinking.
But if we've got all this... The other thing that was announced the other day is that huge AUKUS deal. Are we just sort of putting numbers out there for the pacification of the Australian public, or what's
absolutely.
The that's what it's all about. It's not about achieving something and coming up with sound defence structure and stuff to protect us. We're just putting out bland numbers for pacification of the local population.
AUKUS is all about making a political announcement and getting the photo op somewhere in California, standing beside a Virginia-class submarine.
Right.
I mean, what's really good about it? And by the way, I wrote 3 articles published in Quadrant about the looming disaster of the previous Barracuda.
Mm.
And then, by the way, Robert Gottliebson got stuck into them on the finances, and Tom Lewis, who's a bit of an expert in defense matters, he got stuck into them. And Ben Packham got stuck into them, which was, and he's got a lot of good contacts inside defense. So everyone was sort of tearing them apart. And suddenly, out of left field, having gone through this for many, many years and spent many, many billions of dollars on it, snap. We're not buying the Barracuda anymore. We're going to buy, we're not quite sure, we're going to have this agreement with the Americans and the Brits, and we'll make a choice between the Astute class and the Virginia class. And in the meantime, as part of the first announcement saying we've now solved the problem by going to nuclear propulsion, not nuclear weapons, we've solved the problem and we're going to make a decision between either the American or the British boat. And in the meantime, we're giving the British, Rishi, $3.4 billion to finish the design of his boat.
Yes. Every time you tell me something, it just says we're doing nothing, absolutely nothing, but we're spending billions of dollars of taxpayers' funds to achieve nothing. This must sound rather weird to our, what I suppose, partners in England and Europe and America.
I think they're laughing all the way to the bank.
Well, we'll just pull up on the bank there because they're another problem we've got, and we'll have a quick break and come right back on a couple of other issues if we may.
You should hear what Kate Shimarani is talking about.
All over the press everywhere in the UK is the story of Philip Schofield working on a show called This Morning. I don't have a telly and I'm really not going to sit and watch that garbage even if I did. But he's admitted that he is a homosexual and that's okay. And then he's now said that he's had some kind of intimate liaisons with a 20-year-old. Is what he said. Now, I'm not there. I wasn't in the room. I've not been there with the camera. Nothing. I'm not going to comment, but everybody else is, and they're calling him a groomer. But I just want to put this to everybody. Would the same press coverage have gone out there if it had been a 60-year-old bloke with a 20-year-old woman having a what we call a heterosexual relationship? I bet it wouldn't have, you sexist bunch.
Kate Shimarani on TNT Radio.
I'll be here to hear what's on your mind.
Kids want to share what's going on in their lives with the adults around them. Parents, grandparents, teachers, coaches, and more. They want to know you're listening, and they want to listen to you. They want your input and guidance, early and often, on all kinds of topics. When it comes to a serious subject like underage drinking, they want to know your expectations, as well as how and why, as a young person, they should avoid alcohol. How you talk about it will change as your child grows. But the important thing is to talk about it. Not just once for an hour when you think the time is right, but in 60 one-minute conversations and more that are part of your everyday talks. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
When you need me, I'll be by your side.
The totalitarian liberals of the West have unilaterally and arrogantly abolished national sovereignty and openly seek to overthrow all who would oppose their bid for global hegemony. Antiwar.com is devoted to the cause of non-interventionism and represents the truly pro-America side of the foreign policy debate. We are already fighting the next information war. We are dedicated to the proposition that war hawks and our leaders are not going to be allowed to get away with it unchallenged. Antiwar.com is dedicated to building an awareness of the globalist and interventionist forces that would enslave us all in a new world order on which the sun never sets. But we can't do it without you. Visit antiwar.com to find out more. A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
Politically Incorrect on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Richard Carson back with you on Politically Incorrect. We're having a chat with a well-known supporter of ours, Alistair Pope, Lieutenant Colonel retired, and we're browsing over some of the inconsistencies that appear to be happening in the defence structure of Australia. So, Alistair, you've given us a pretty good outline of where we might be a little bit deficient. Other things that have been bothering me somewhat, and that is China appears to have its claws into Australia in many areas. And you'd mentioned something along the lines of the major infrastructure of China's, you know, ownership of what, power generation, things like this, yep. And also yep. ports. So over the last, 15 or 20 years, we've just sort of passed on our inheritances and passed it over to, or half passed over ports and things to China. Where does that leave us in a defensive structure or in an economic situation?
You're actually quite wrong. We've managed to achieve this total sell-off of Australia in about 8 years.
We've really been
on the gold standard of getting rid of Australia. Now, I mean, among other things, I was appalled when we sold the port of Darwin. And now, in fact, we're going to build a second port beside it. So we sell one to the Chinese and then we build another one. And the Americans were quite alarmed, actually, because they have a rotation of about a brigade strength, about 3,000 soldiers come through Darwin for training.
Whoops, we've lost you.
Training, because we've got a very large training area up there, and the American Air Force comes down because they can bomb Northern Territory, which is always a good thing anyway. But they actually use that because and they absolutely appreciate it because they can fly low, they can do everything, they can bomb in the bombing range there, whereas wherever they are, say in Guam, they've got a very tiny area that they can actually, you know, practice their bombing on. So in fact, they were alarmed at that. But the other thing is, I don't know if you knew that we sold Cubby Station, which was the largest rice growing station in Australia. It used to belong to John, who was the Foster's guy, John Elliott.
Cubby Station in Queensland.
Yeah, I
know a bit about that because I came from out west of there one day. And it's a major thing, and it's got a lot of water, but it was sold to the Chinese, and they're producing cotton, I think you'll find.
Yes, and the other thing is, of course, that we sold the Murray-Darling water rights to the Chinese, who have, in fact, been restricting the allocation of water to a lot of the irrigators because they want it for themselves. I mean, they bought it. So when you look at, and then, of course, they bought into other places. They bought the port of Newcastle. They bought a place called Cockatoo Island, not the one in Sydney, but one off the north coast of Western Australia, which had an iron mine on it. Not a particularly good one, in fact, compared to the better iron mines that we've got. It'd become quite uneconomic. So the Chinese bought it for a bit of a song, and I don't even know if they're bothering to produce anything from it. The point was, it's right next to one of our major training areas. They bought Keswick Island off Queensland, where they then quite illegally knocked the top off the mountain and put up lots of aerials. And in fact, the locals there are up in arms because of the environmental destruction that's gone on, where they just ignored all the rules. and this has actually been accelerating. They've been buying into a lot of our industries. You might have seen the Belt and Road, of course, that Dan Andrews, Dan Demick, actually tried to start up. But even though he didn't get that, he hired a Chinese company.
What was his idea? What is when they say Belt and Road, I mean, what are they doing? Building and owning the roads and infrastructure? Is that what it's all about?
Yeah. They wanted the Chinese wanted to actually create this Belt and Road system. It's called the New Silk Road.
Right.
And they've actually been building a railway line all the way from China through to Germany.
Yep.
But the bits that are completed are actually quite impressive. And that way they can just actually go overland, but they also started buying up all these ports. Now, the ports are quite strategic. As you know, they've managed to trap Sri Lanka into the debt trap.
Yep.
Which can't get out. They've got a port in Pakistan, which they took over. And then sealed off and put about, I believe it was about 1,500 soldiers in as security guards.
Interesting.
So basically they've now got an overseas base there. They've bought into Djibouti, which means they can now look very closely at the American Fifth Fleet. So they have in fact been expanding around the world. Their blue water navy is not particularly blue. It can't really go that far yet. But they've now got more ships than the Americans. They've got over, they're actually launching about one ship every 2 weeks.
That's an astounding rate, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it seems like
a lot to me.
It still takes you about 2 years to build a ship. We, of course, have been building the Hunter class frigates for, I think, about 7 or 8 years, and we haven't produced one yet. And they've got a slight problem, as we mentioned before. They're too heavy. They're no longer frigates. They're destroyers. But we didn't upgrade the power pack, so now they can't go as fast. And one of the things they're supposed to do is find submarines, but I went along to a presentation put on by British Aerospace and said, can you find the Barracuda? And by the way, the looks of horror on everyone's face, I should ask such a rude question. But the guy from British Aerospace said, I don't know. And I said, well, we're either wasting a lot of money buying and building sub-hunters that can't find submarines, or if you can find it, we're wasting a lot of money on the Barracuda. And by the way, interesting, go back a step here.
Yeah.
We were going to convert a nuclear-powered submarine into a conventional-powered submarine using diesel.
That was the French ones.
Yeah, that was the French one. When we cancelled that and then said, no, we're going to buy the American Virginia or the Astute, the British Astute, why didn't we just go back and say, we'll have the Barracuda? It's nuclear-powered anyway.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't know because I'm not a defense expert or anything.
No, that's not expert. We actually took a nuclear-powered submarine to convert it and then said, no, we want to go nuclear, but we're not having yours.
Why is there such a pickle over having nuclear? Because this would lead into my theory on why we don't have nuclear power in Australia with all the uranium we have.
There has, in fact, of course, been this huge fear campaign. Now, one of the quick questions is, how many people died after Chernobyl, which was, in fact, the worst nuclear disaster, civil power disaster? There were 64 people registered as having died of that. Now, Helen Caldicott in Tasmania said there will be up to 100,000 people a year dying of this. And then along came Fukushima, in which there's some very spectacular pictures taken from afar of the roof being blown off. And this was not a nuclear explosion. This was actually hydrogen, which had built up inside because the heat from the reactor was actually splitting the water into hydrogen and oxygen, which then got a spark and blew the roof off. So that was just a normal type explosion. There was no meltdown. There was a radiation leak which went into the Pacific Ocean where you can't even detect it anymore. And how many people died? Zero. Now, again,
here we go. We're beating up stories for no particular reason. Now, coming back to the ports of Darwin and all of that infrastructure, where we're there, we then come back to everyone wanting, or too many people carrying on about net zero. And the energy efficiency. Now you've got the Chinese owning, I think, a fair slice of the energy production. And now I think the Australian government's pushing to have whatever net zero equates to, based on the premise of climate change, which I would suggest might be a bit of a furphy. What sort of capacity is there in wind and solar for energy or electricity production? Is it?
Well, there isn't.
I mean, 7% or something if it all went well.
No, it's 4% at the moment. The thing is, what you're looking at, the 7% is actually what's called the nameplate. If it's working efficiently, it will produce, if all the windmills and all the solar panels were working efficiently, right, it would produce 7% for the trillions of dollars we've spent of our energy. Now, it's a while since I've driven a wind-powered car or one that's run by a solar panel. They do, in fact, have a race between Darwin and Adelaide, solar-powered cars. You might have heard about that.
Yeah.
So you get one guy in a thing that looks like a Dodgem, and he races down the road there with his solar panels. Now, that's never going to work. When I was working in the oil industry, when I started there was a huge panic on because we were down to what we thought was 40 years of oil. And, of course, people like Paul Ehrlich had already announced that there would not be a drop of oil in the world by the year 2000. And that was part of the Club of Rome. Yeah. Now, I got involved in this. And one of the reasons I'm retired now, although I'm just old and decrepit, one of the reasons I retired was because we'd found so much oil that if we never found another drop, we've got more than 150 years' supply.
But you were involved in ascertaining where this oil was in Australia or worldwide?
No, worldwide.
Worldwide. So Yeah, well, yeah. I've heard numbers like that as well, and that's what they've found or what's out there right now. But it's probably a factor of 10 times more than that anyway.
You
would not know. the fear process in all of this, but I just wonder if we were to run this net zero nonsense, that if we had a full capacity of 7%, that's 93% of the day when we don't have any. What happens?
Yeah, and no transport.
Yeah, well,
because you're not allowed to use gas or oil or petrol or diesel or any of those things to drive your transport around. So how do you drive? You can't. How do you make pharmaceuticals without oil?
That's a classic, that one alone. I mean, so much comes from the refining of oil that's not funny, and people don't seem to understand that. But again, then we come back to our erstwhile legacy media. No one asks a question. If we're going to have no oil refining, what the hell do we replace everything that currently comes from that sector of the industry? Plastics, you name it. Where does the alternative product come from?
I wrote an article, actually, and I did a presentation on the myth of oil spills. And what I pointed out, my theory was that oil spills are actually good for the environment.
Right.
And that surprised the audience.
You're very counter-cyclical.
Very much so. contrarian, I think, is the word.
Contrarian is very good.
Contrarian.
Yep, yep.
But what I actually did there was I started off, there was supposed to be about 40 people turned up. Actually, only 19 did. And the only reason I was giving this talk was because the actual lecturer, presenter that night at Jim Simpson's Five Dog failed to turn up. So I said, well, I can do a presentation for you. So what I did was I handed out a slip of paper and I said, vote now. Are oil spills good or bad for the environment? 18 of the 19 people who attended said they're bad. And the other guy abstained.
Right.
At the end of it, I got 17 people said oil spills are good for the environment. One said, no, they're still bad. You haven't convinced me. And the guy who had abstained the first time still abstained.
He was a courageous fellow. But in saying that the oil spill is good for the environment, obviously there's spin-offs of it all leaching back into the waters or whatever else. Is that the go with it?
No. See, the point here is the Persian Gulf actually was a great example of that when Kuwait opened up the oil wells and poured tens of millions of gallons of oil into the Persian Gulf. In fact, at one stage there, I've got a photo of it, the oil floating down the coast was about 3 feet thick.
Wow.
And now, the Persian Gulf is a great place to spill oil. The reason being that it's warm, the temperature of the water there is over 30 degrees. And so what you had was a very rapid evaporation. The kerosenes, the light oils, all evaporated within 4 days. So then you end up with what the environmentalists love, and that's heavy oil. And this is when you get the pictures of the pelican that's covered in oil and it's going to die. By the way, that pelican didn't die. They saved it. But it was on the front cover of National Geographic.
Of course.
So you have this heavy oil that comes down there, and if you pick it up, it's very gooey.
Yeah.
And it'll stain your hands, and it's sticky, and it's horrible. Within another few days, say about 10 to 12 days, this actually turns into what are called coke balls. Because basically you've got the sun, you've got, in other words, UV rays, you've got the salty soup called the sea with all the chemicals in it, and it basically starts forming new compounds. And then it saturates and it sinks to the bottom. And in fact, what happened was that about 3 years after they'd actually cleaned all this up, they didn't clean it up, it just disappeared.
Right.
Some divers went down to find out where it had all gone. And found literally a tarmac road on the bottom of the Persian Gulf. Terrible, terrible, terrible. Think of all the clams that died. Except it was actually covered. And if you ever watch a bitumen road that's not being used, the seagrasses were now growing through it because what's oil made of? Nitrogen, hydrogen, and oxygen.
Very nutritious products for growing things.
Called fertilizer.
Yep.
And in fact, they started building, and by the way, because it's only Euphrates and the Tigris going into the Persian Gulf, it's very, very salty, and there's not enough fresh water goes in, so there's very little nutrients in the Persian Gulf. You might catch a few fish. there was an absolute bloom of a fish called Hamas, which is very much like Barramundi.
Right.
And they built whole fishing fleets to catch this stuff. So whenever you went to the Middle East, what's for lunch today? Hamas. Not again. because there was just so much food. And in fact, that, of course, was 1991. It took about 20 years, which takes you through until 2011, before all of that nutrient, tens of millions of barrels of oil that had been poured in there, was being used up. And I pointed out at the end of this, we desperately needed another huge oil spill into the Persian Gulf.
Well, listen, we're desperately out of time all of a sudden, but that was most instructive. And we probably need about 7 or 8 weeks to get all of your knowledge out of you and put it onto a tape. But I better say for today, Alistair, thank you very much for being on Politically Incorrect. And we will no doubt try and get you back from your luxury villa at some stage in the near future. But for today, thank you very much for being part of our show. All the best.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Richard.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.